Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight you're going to hear the side of Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Let me tell you a little bit about the story that has gone on worldwide over the past couple of weeks. A doctor who persuaded millions of parents worldwide that a common vaccine could cause autism was barred from practicing medicine in his native Britain after the country's top medical group found that he conducted his research unethically. Dr. Andrew Wakefield was the first researcher to publish a peer-reviewed study suggesting a connection between autism and the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. That prompted many parents to abandon the vaccine in moves that epidemiologists feared could lead to outbreaks of the potentially deadly disease. Now, tonight, Dr. Wakefield will tell his side of the story. He is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital's Medical School, part of the University of London, in 1981, and he pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He has published more than 130 original scientific articles, book chapters, and invited scientific commentaries. His work tonight, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind a Tragedy. Here's Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be with you.
Let's start, first of all, if you can, just tell me a little bit about how you uncovered this connection between autism and the vaccine.
Well, you know, it's really a very simple story, and it starts as all medical stories should begin, and that's in the clinic. And it starts by listening to the patient or to the patient's parents. And that's the essence of good medicine. And in May 1995, parents started calling me and saying my child was perfectly normal. They were speaking, they were interacting up to 15 months of age. They then had an MMR vaccine. They had a prolonged fever. They were never quite the same again. They then started to slip away, lose their skills. They could no longer speak or interact with their siblings. They wouldn't play. They would sit in a corner just doing the same thing time and time and time again. And eventually they were diagnosed with autism. And I said, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm a gastroenterologist. I know nothing about autism. When I was at medical school, it was so rare that we weren't even taught about it. And the parents said, well, the problem is my child has terrible gastrointestinal problems. The doctor dismisses them out of hand, but they've got diarrhea, bloating. I know they're in pain. They've lost the ability to speak. They're banging their head against a wall. And I know it's because they're in pain. And I'm sure what's going on in their intestine is related to what's going on in their behavior and their brain function. So what we did, quite simply, was what we are professionally and morally obliged to do, and that is to take the parent's story to investigate those children, and lo and behold, they had a bowel disease. They had an intestinal disease which the medical profession had ignored, had dismissed, and had said, your kid's autistic, they're just bound to have these problems. Well, that is not true. And when we treated the bowel disease with standard anti-inflammatory treatment that we would give for patients with Crohn's or colitis, then not only did the bowel symptoms get better, the diarrhea improved, the pain disappeared, but the behavior improved and the autistic features improved. And that was the beginning of a very, very interesting, if somewhat turbulent, journey.
And let's point this out from the outset. You are not opposed to vaccines specifically, are you?
Not at all. Absolutely not. I am for a safety-first vaccination policy. And that has to be absolutely the key. Why would anyone resist a safety-first vaccine policy? If you're going to administer vaccines to healthy children, indeed all the children of the world, that is the intention, then you have to be absolutely certain that you have done everything to determine the safety of the vaccines and the schedule. And that is what I'm in favor of.
I was opposed to the H1N1 vaccine because I thought that they rushed it too soon. And I truly question sometimes the motives of Big Pharma. Andrew, now, in your particular situation, tell me what happened. Why were you barred from practicing medicine in Britain? What happened? What's the politics behind that?
Well, the main charge against my colleagues and I, and my colleagues included the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologist. Please bear this in mind. Your listeners need to know that Professor John Walker Smith was the founding father of the discipline of pediatric gastroenterology. So a man whose now retired, but who has had an unimpeachable career. He has devoted his life to the care of children. And the charge against us was that we conducted unethical research on these children without the appropriate approvals. We did not. We absolutely did not. These children were investigated for their clinical symptoms. This was clinical medicine. It was like a child going to a doctor with a sore throat and having a throat swab done, a blood test done. It was no more than that. It was saying, what are the presenting symptoms in these children, and therefore, what are the tests that need to be done to get to their diagnosis? And the regulatory body in the UK, the General Medical Council, said this was research. It was not. It most specifically was not. There was a research element to the work that was done by me, and that was looking in great detail, down the microscope, at the tissues, the biopsies taken from these children during their clinical colonoscopy. And we did that to characterize the disease, and that research was covered by an appropriate ethical committee approval. And how the GMC confused this is so bizarre, and I describe this in the book Callous Disregard, present the factual evidence so that people can judge for themselves, that led me to believe that their minds were made up before we ever went into the chamber and before ever a word of evidence was heard.
Well, you know, Dr. Wakefield, you're stepping on the toes of a multi-billion dollar industry, and they don't want you talking, do they?
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and you characterized it well with the H1N1 scenario. There you have a scare created, a pandemic predicted, what turns out to be a mountain made out of a molehill. It was one of the mildest flu viruses on record, and the drug companies made an absolute killing on this. And there is a great deal of anxiety now in the European Parliament, where the committee that ordered this, an internal committee at the World Health Organization, is under investigation because many people on that committee actually were representing the pharmaceutical industry and were paid by them as consultants. And that kind of conflict of interest is unacceptable, and it led the taxpayer to having to fork out for what was, it turns out to be, no problem at all. And the major problem was that a vaccine that was untested for safety was rushed onto the market. And I think there have been a large number of problems occurring in terms of adverse reactions following that.
All right, Andrew, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come right back and talk about your work, Callous Disregard. It's an incredible story. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who blew the lid on the connection between autism and vaccines, the MMR vaccine specifically. Dr. Andrew, what was it about that vaccine that you found that you just didn't like?
Well, when I got involved in this, I went back into the history of the safety studies of vaccines before they were licensed, and I wrote a 250-page report which analyzed all of the safety studies looking at measles right the way through to when it was combined as measles, mumps, rubella. And I have to say I was appalled by the studies. They were not only inadequate, but they were short-term. They lasted for no more than 3 or 4 or 5 weeks at the most, and these are viruses that can hang around and cause long-term problems, and there were no long-term safety studies at all. And I put this to my colleagues. I said there is a major problem here. The studies have not been done, and in particular, my worry was that when you combine three live viruses in one mixture and do not do adequate safety testing on it, then you're going to run into trouble because those viruses interfere with each other. If I went to the Food and Drug Administration with three antihypertensive, three blood pressure drugs, and I said, I've taken these three drugs and put them in the same tablet, and I want to give them to a patient because I've done the safety studies on the individual tablets, they would throw me out the door. They would show me the door and say, you're going to kill people if you do this because these drugs will potentiate the adverse reaction risk. And that is exactly what seems to have happened with the combination MMR.
Now, you, as you were doing your work, you had an opportunity to talk with a government whistleblower. His name was George as well. And what did he tell you? What were his revelations?
Yes, his code name was George. And George was brought across from Canada in 1987 to advise the British government on the introduction of MMR, where they'd already introduced it in Canada. Canada had introduced a vaccine called Trivirix, which had to be withdrawn very early on because it caused meningitis. It was unsafe. That same vaccine was rebranded, just given a new name, the exact same vaccine called Pluzarix, and licensed in the UK in the same month that it was withdrawn in Canada. And this was an extraordinary situation. The British government or the regulatory authorities in the UK were aware that it had been withdrawn in Canada because it was dangerous, and yet they introduced it in the UK. And that is a measure of how much I think they care about the issue of safety. And George had advised them not to introduce it because of the problems, and they ignored him. And over the next 4 years, there were repeated problems with the vaccine, with increasing numbers of cases of meningitis in the UK. These were ignored, they were dismissed, and finally, a small amount of money was put into a study in a university in Nottingham in England, which showed beyond doubt the rate of meningitis with this vaccine was very much higher than had previously been thought. The vaccine was withdrawn overnight, and the vaccine, sadly, not taken off the market, but then shipped out to developing countries where it has also caused epidemics of meningitis. So a very questionable ethical and moral practice, the British government introducing a vaccine that was knowingly unsafe. And the rub to this, the real problem underlying this, is that when I got involved in this, there was a legal action by parents against the manufacturers, and they thought, and I thought, and the lawyers thought it was against the manufacturers. But it wasn't. As it turns out, and as George disclosed to me, the government had underwritten the liability of the company because the company, SmithKline-Beecham, had said, we don't want to introduce this vaccine because it's unsafe.
Oh, I think my gosh.
It's extraordinary. Extraordinary situation.
And you know, Andrew, we see this time and time again here in the United States where the FDA will approve some kind of pill, some drug, and then a year later, 2 years later, they've got to yank it off the market. Because people are dying. People are getting sick from these things. Why do they rush these things to marketplace?
Well, it is extraordinary, this relationship between the regulators and the pharmaceutical industry is something that's a complete mystery to me and is certainly not something that operates in the patient's best interests. And it's something that really needs to be put right.
Because I mean, we even knew it passed in the years gone past. I think they've changed it now, but you know, pharmaceutical companies were able to take doctors on trips and, you know, just kind of like make them feel very welcome. And then the doctors, of course, would recommend that specific drug because he was thinking about the company all the time.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem. And the most recent problem that's really thrown this into sharp relief is the fact that one of the publishing companies that publishes a lot of reputable scientific journals was producing fake publications that looked like scientific journals, which were actually sponsored by Merck Pharmaceuticals and were extremely favorable to their drugs. So there you have a perversion of the scientific process where people are led to believe when they read these magazines that they are true scientific articles when they are, in fact, are not.
Has this vaccine, the MMR vaccine that you believed was responsible for autism, has this specific vaccine been changed now where it's no longer a threat, or is it still out there?
No, it's still out there, and the consensus amongst the regulators is there's no problem. And you hear from the government there's no problem, there's no link. And yet, George, what has been going on since 1991 in this country is the vaccine court. The government vaccine courts have been settling cases of vaccine-induced autism. They have confirmed that vaccines, including MMR vaccine, can cause or materially contribute to autism. So you've got one branch of the government saying, yes, there is proof of settling these cases. And on the other hand, you've got them saying that it's safe. Now, which is true?
Yeah.
I have a clear feeling of which I believe is true.
Actress and comedian Jenny McCarthy, who's got a little boy named Evan, has autism as well. She, of course, is a staunch believer of the connection between autism and vaccines. She's very vocal about that. Are you beginning to get more and more support in spite of what things like your native country has done to you?
Yes, I think that this is what they fear most of all and why they have to try and silence me by taking away my license, which they won't do. I'm not going to walk away from this. The problem is too big. Wherever I go in the world, I was in China recently. There is a huge problem. They have 4 to 5 million children, they estimate, with autism, and the story is exactly the same. And these parents aren't anti-vaccine. They took their children to be vaccinated on time, and their children regressed following the vaccine. Now, that doesn't prove that the vaccine was the cause, but it makes it absolutely essential that it is investigated to the ends of the earth to establish whether or not there is a relationship.
Isn't that the big issue right now? And this is one of the things you really want. You just want a major, no conflict of interest investigation.
That's absolutely right. It's essential, and it is essential not only to establish whether there is a relationship or not, but to underpin public confidence in vaccination policy. Because as soon as the public lose confidence in vaccine policymakers, then it destroys vaccine policy potentially across the board, and that leads to potential catastrophe. And so those who are ultimately anti-vaccine are the ones who refuse to do these studies, who will not invest in the safety examination of these vaccines properly, and who deny children who are injured some kind of safety net, some kind of compensation by denying vaccine injury, because then parents will lose confidence, and vaccine, all the good that vaccination has done, will be destroyed virtually overnight.
Dr. Andrew Wakefield, tell me a little bit about autism, this affliction. Exactly what is it? What does it do?
Right. It was described by a doctor called Leo Kanner in 1943. It was first described then, so it seems that it did not exist in any recognizable form before that time. It's described according to its behavioral features, in other words, how the child presents to you at that time in the clinic. And it is characterized by lack of socialization, lack of communication, repetitive behaviors, loss of eye contact or absence of eye contact, absence of overt emotion or physical and emotional contact with peers, no interest in play, this kind of thing. It's a socially devastating problem. But beyond the behavioral aspects are clear physical problems with these children. Their immune system isn't working well. Their intestines are not functioning properly. And there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that the intestine may be the source of the problem in many, many children, which sounds to people rather confusing. But in fact, the link between the bowel and the brain is one that's firmly established in medicine. We are, if you like, what we eat. And toxins from the intestine can undoubtedly have an impact upon brain and behavior. So it's now becoming increasingly recognized that this is a much more than just a neurological or a brain disease. It's a what we call a systemic or whole body disease. And the recognition of that has led to huge advances in our understanding and treatment of the problem. And Jenny McCarthy's little boy, Evan, is the beneficiary of that that knowledge and that intervention, and the fact that he's got a determined mother who's going to get to the bottom of the problem, and he's doing very well.
Absolutely, and that's good news. Why do they say that children who have this compulsion with stacking things up and being orderly, why do they say that's autistic? To me, that's almost genius.
Well, it would be wonderful if it were meaningful. This is the problem, is if it were done for the purpose of tidying up their bedroom, for example, that would be wonderful. But it's a repetitive exercise which could go on for hours and hours and hours, and does not actually have any achievement. So what they will do is they will watch the same segment of a video, say Thomas the Tank Engine, and they will watch the same segment for hours and hours, rewinding, going back, doing it again. And it is a reflection of a perseveration, if you like, that is clearly abnormal and not consistent with, I've seen that, I've done that, move on and find out what the next bit shows. And so it's something that is a fundamental part of the autistic syndrome and something which we need to understand a great deal more about.
If this was first beginning to be discovered in 1943, when did the vaccine come out?
The MMR vaccine did not come along till much later, and no one is saying that all autism is caused by vaccines. Indeed, we know that there were cases of autism before vaccines came along that were caused by, for example, the drug thalidomide,
the
drug that caused limb abnormalities.
Right, they look like little flippers, right?
That's right. sodium valproate, another drug that can cause autism, taken by the mother during pregnancy. And, George, the really interesting thing as far as this argument is concerned, it is that it is known that exposure during pregnancy to viruses such as measles, mumps, and rubella, or early after, in the period after pregnancy, can lead to autism. And so there you have historical evidence that these three viruses in their natural form can be associated with autism in the child. So is it possible that when you put them together in the combination, they increase that risk? And that is something that certainly merits investigation.
Did we see a spike in autism once the vaccine came out?
Yes, there's a paper that's just come out, extremely interesting paper, which looked at the time trends in the number of new children presenting with autism, and it shows a clear sort of hockey stick effect in the UK, in Japan, and around the world when the MMR vaccine was introduced. It narrows it down to a 2 to 3 year time window, which is quite extraordinary. You can pinpoint the change in that, in the shape of that curve, the incidence curve, to that point. And so the data are certainly consistent with the disease taking off with the introduction of that vaccine.
There was an expert witness who was giving evidence against you, criticizing you for not disclosing what he called a conflict of interest during your research. I want you to explain that and also explain the fact that wasn't that person, that witness, also being paid by the government and drug companies to do his own research?
Yes. Now, this is the person you refer to is the sort of doyen of autism in the UK, Professor Sir Michael Rutter. And he was an expert witness against me and my colleagues at the General Medical Council. And in addition, he has appeared in US vaccine court and the UK vaccine court on behalf of the defendants, that is the government or the pharmaceutical companies. Now, he, ironically, was the first to describe the link between vaccines and autism. So people say Dr. Wakefield was the first. In fact, in 1994, Professor Rutter produced a paper showing that one child that he described had regressed into autism following immunization. And he labeled it as the probable cause, which is something that we never said. So, you know, if we're irresponsible, then he is highly irresponsible. What we said is that this study, our original study, never proves an association, let alone a causal association. So we were very sober in any contentions that we made. But Rutter stood up at the General Medical Council and said that because I had agreed to undertake a study on behalf of the lawyers, a research study in the UK, that this should have been disclosed in the Lancet paper, the paper in 1998 that first described the syndrome. Well, none of the children in that study, none of them, were at the time of their referral to the Royal Free Hospital, were involved in litigation. So there was no conflict.
Now, you've suggested the connection between autism and the vaccines, but you do say we don't know for sure one way or another. We don't know if it's the vaccine, and or we don't know that it is the is not the vaccine. In these particular cases, what percent of children that just get a vaccine end up coming down with autism?
It's a very good question, George, and we don't have the answer to that. And that is the reason for that is that causation is highly complex. And let me just characterize that in a nutshell, that people in this country have suggested that the thimerosal preservative, the mercury preservative, which is in other vaccines, not the MMR, may also be involved. And that's entirely right. Plausible because that substance, mercury, ethyl mercury, a preservative that should never, ever have been in the vaccine because it's highly toxic, can damage the immune system. So if your immune system is hit with successive vaccines containing this mercury compound, and then you get an MMR on top of it, a live viral vaccine, the immune system may just put up its hands and say, I don't get it. So you have a complex interaction between these things, potentially. And this is something that's never been looked at. No one has ever done a safety study of the schedule that children actually get in the real world. We've now done that study, a primate study using rhesus macaque monkeys, asking just that question. What are the neurological and the intestinal and the immune consequences of giving the schedule? And the results are starting to emerge now, and they're really quite alarming.
Well, and we've seen things happen time and time again. The simian virus situation, for fighting and combating polio, growing this on monkey kidneys and, you know, harvesting things like that. What is it? Is it, in your opinion, because I'm sure there's some great researchers out there who really want to make a difference. They want to put a dent into disease and afflictions. How much does the money end of it weigh? You know, profit, let's get these things out the marketplace, let's make money. And how much of it is we truly want to help humanity? What's the weighing percent there?
Well, I think the scientists, from the scientist point of view and the medical point of view, the clearly the will is to do good for the people, for the pharmaceutical companies. The interest is the bottom line. It is the stock price. It is returns to shareholders. And that is their principal concern. They have to abide by certain safety rules, but that is not, I have to say, their priority in my experience. One example of this is the latest debacle over the rotavirus vaccine, where they have said, oh, it's been tested in millions of children and it's absolutely safe. And then way down the line, after it's been given, millions of doses have been given, they find that it contains the genetic material of two pig viruses, one of which is known to cause a wasting fatal disease in young pigs. Now, that's appalling. That's an utter disgrace that years down the line, this virus is found in there. When they found it in one vaccine, they took it off the market. When they found it in both vaccines, they put both vaccines back on the market. That, to me, is absolutely extraordinary and unacceptable. And one of the regulators said the benefits of this vaccine far outweigh the potential risks. That is totally dishonest because they have absolutely no knowledge of the medium or long-term risks of that pig virus in those vaccines, none at all. And so to mislead the American public by saying that the benefits greatly outweigh the risks is entirely false.
Okay, well, you stay with us, Andrew. We will talk for one more hour. We're going to open up the phone lines next as we continue our dialogue. His work, Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, the Truth Behind a Tragedy. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Andrew, at what age do parents realize that their children might be autistic, and what are the signs that they can look for?
Well, historically, children were never thought to be right from very early on. So they never wanted to be picked up. They never held out their arms as babies. They didn't cry. They were often described as being very good babies, never asking for anything. And then it emerged as time went on that the children were not developing in the way of normal children. Now, more recently, there has been a huge upsurge in regressive autism, where the child develops normally for a long time, up to, so we know, midway through the second year of life, and then starts to lose skills. And that is becoming much more of a common presentation. And the signs that parents might look for are loss of eye contact. Child doesn't have shared attention. They don't want to engage with their siblings. They don't want to play anymore. And they start to lose the words that they had, mama, dada, these kinds of things. They start to lose those words. Bizarrely, I've had experiences where a child has been saying helicopter, very, very complex words.
Sure.
With 50 or 100 other words. And the parents, you know, the next week after he starts to regress, he can say copter. And the week after that, he can just say copter. And then he stops speaking altogether. And the doctor says, oh, your child, you think he was saying helicopter, but he was just making noises. No. Helicopter is a highly complex word. And parents know their children extremely well. So you've got to listen to the parents, because that's where the clues come from.
Can this affliction be totally reversed?
I've rarely seen total reversal. I have, on occasion, maybe three or four children seen complete reversal from classic autism, profound autism, to a child who is indistinguishable from normal and who, in many ways, is supernormal. You know, they have a skill that goes beyond that of normal children, but that is unusual. However, there is so much of this disorder that is treatable, and what we tend to talk about now is managed recovery. In other words, there are interventions like exclusion diets, which have been found to be extremely effective in some children, and as long as that diet is maintained, then the road to recovery is sustained as well, and going off the diet can reverse that process. Now, that's not every child, but there is clearly a great deal of scope for hope and optimism about the future.
What do you think of chelation?
I have no personal experience of it at all. I've never been involved in chelating a child. Chelation is a technique used for pulling metals, toxic metals, out of the body. And it has to be done under expert supervision because it also has the effect of pulling beneficial metals out of the body that are needed for cells to function.
It's used with the EDTA, right?
That's one technique. EDTA, DMSA is another technique. And these are drugs that can be taken orally or given intravenously. But again, I have no personal experience of their use. They should be done under close supervision, and they should be done. The indication for doing these is demonstrating that the child has a heavy metal burden in their bodies, and that is usually done by what is called a provocation test, pulling them out in the urine and demonstrating that the urinary levels of these metals are high. And it is something that deserves thorough testing in a properly designed safety study in the autistic population, to see if it is both safe and beneficial to the children.
Well, people are calling you from all over the planet, and we've only got about 40 minutes or so with you left, so let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Andrew is there. Andrew, you're on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, George, Mr. Wakefield. About 8 years ago, I became aware of Mr. Alex Jones, who talked about the danger of vaccines, and 2 years after that, I had my first child. And I took it seriously enough to make sure she had no vaccines, and she didn't. And she had a very sickless childhood. She was never sick growing up. But I know that some of these vaccines contain mercury or thimerosal, and some don't. But I've heard Alex on many occasions mention that they contain what he calls cancer viruses, and I was just curious if the guests knew what he was talking about.
Yes, the virus that he was referring to, I think, was one that George referred to earlier, which was simian virus 40, which was found in be a contaminant in the polio vaccines, which has been linked to cancer, in particular a cancer called mesothelioma, which is a cancer of the lining of the lungs. But there is no doubt that extraneous DNA, genetic material from viruses in these vaccines, can be a potential long-term problem in terms of causing cancer, and one should be very, very cautious about putting what is called naked DNA from other viruses into humans. Very, very cautious. So I think that was the reference that Alex Jones was making.
Dr. Wakefield, what does a parent do today? Let's say there's a woman, she's pregnant, she's going to have a baby in a week. What do they do? I mean, they may be for vaccines, maybe they're not, but maybe they're just confused. What do they do?
Well, it's a very difficult situation, and we've been put in this situation now by a failure of the regulatory authorities and the companies to do the appropriate safety studies. There's no doubt about that. Take, for example, the hepatitis B vaccine given on day one. Now, that is a universal policy. Hepatitis B in this country is largely a disease of sexual promiscuity and intravenous drug abuse. Clearly, that is not relevant to infants on the first day of life. And that policy, which we've recently studied, has never been investigated for safety as far as we can see in the literature. Now, that's extraordinary. To give a vaccine on the first day of life for a disease which a child is extremely unlikely to encounter for the most part for many, many years, because it is convenient, because they can do it, is not acceptable. And I think that what parents have to do, and this is the single message I would ask them to take away, is to think critically about vaccines, not to accept what your doctor says at face value, but to read, get informed. There's a lot of information out there now. And doctors, likewise, get informed. Do not take what you hear from the Centers for Disease Control and the manufacturers to be the truth until you have investigated it for yourself. And so that is my message, to think critically about vaccines. These are not in any way innocuous substances, and they're being put into children in a one-size-fits-all manner, and it clearly is not the case.
To Houston, Texas we go. First-time caller, Sharon, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, it's great to talk to both of you. I wanted to share another experience that we had with the MMR vaccination. Granddaughter who, she was one, so I guess that would have been close to her first or second administration, developed ITP. chronic, it was a acute ITP, and Dr. Wakefield probably could speak to that. It's listed as one of the possible side effects, but when we discussed it with the doctor, it was complete denial that there was any association between that and the vaccination that she had had. And anyway, I just wanted to share that and say there's other concerns out there with this particular vaccination.
That's right. I mean, here we have an issue of informed consent. Now, there is no doubt that ITP, now this refers to what's called idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura. So it is an immune reaction against the platelets in the body that cause the blood to clot normally. And so the platelet levels fall and the children start to develop bruising. And it can potentially be a very severe reaction. It is a recognized adverse reaction of the MMR vaccine. So when a doctor says to the parent, it has absolutely nothing to do with it, he clearly has not read the product insert and does not know the scientific literature. And so this comes right back to the issue of informed consent. The doctors should know, and they do not appear to know, and that is not good enough. You cannot give up your responsibility to your individual patients. So you're quite right. This is a complication of the vaccine. It's known to be a complication, and it's the sort of thing that parents need to be informed about. This is not an anti-vaccine argument. It is saying that parents have absolutely the right and should have the right to make an informed choice about how they protect their children from diseases.
If you, Dr. Wakefield, if you were put in charge of the FDA, if it was your mandate to make sure things that went to marketplace were safe, what would you do about vaccine safety testing right now?
I would do two things in the short term. I would demand that there was a thorough study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated children to look at medium to long-term health outcomes. In other words, children who've had the full vaccine schedule compared to children who have not had any vaccines. And I would ask the question, what is the difference between those two groups in terms of long-term health outcomes? Parents have every right to expect that should have been done, and yet it is not. The other study that I would do, and in fact this is one that we have done, is vaccines are often tested in monkeys before being put into humans, and this is the ideal model for testing prior to clinical trials. I would demand that a model is set up whereby all the vaccine schedule is given, and the new vaccine that they want to license is put into that model. So to ask the question, does it produce an additive effect, an adverse reaction, rather than just being tested in isolation? So put the vaccine into the existing schedule, not just test it on its own in the absence of the existing schedule. Those are the two things that I would do as a matter of urgency.
Why can't we get someone like you in that kind of a position who at least would question or at least mandate to his staff, I want research. I want this stuff to be fail-safe. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think it's a very good point. I mean, I don't think that I will ever find my way back into favor. So,
no, probably not.
But nonetheless, the big problem has come is because within, for example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, you have an organization that is not only advocating and mandating vaccines, but on the other hand is also responsible for monitoring vaccine safety. Well, that's like refereeing your own football match. You cannot do that in an unbiased way. And safety assessment needs to be taken out of the CDC and put into an entirely independent organization that is free from conflict of interest, free from pharmaceutical industry influences, and they should be on the back of the FDA and on the back of the CDC on a daily basis demanding improved safety.
Let's go to Chicago. Paul, east of the Rockies. Got to be happy about those Blackhawks, Paul, huh?
Yeah. Gentlemen, I'm worried about some of these things that they've been producing lately, like the FDA-approved live virus vaccine for flus, various flus. I'm like you, Mr. Norrie. I don't get flu shots. In fact, most of the people that I know that have had them aren't with us anymore. And, by the way, whatever happened to that SARS thing?
To SARS?
Yeah.
It went out the door. It never amounted to what they said it would be.
Well, it sure was hot. It was hot on everything, like Lassa fever was, and that went out the door.
I don't get the flu shot, Andrew. I tell my audience they can do what they want, but I just tell them what I do, and then they make up their own minds. But I haven't had the flu since I can remember, and I don't get the vaccine.
Yeah, I think one of my big anxieties about the flu vaccine is that there was a mandate to a recommendation to remove thimerosal from childhood vaccines. And so that was instituted because thimerosal should never have been in there. Now, at the same time that it was being taken out of routine childhood vaccines, it was being put into flu vaccines, and those were then put into the childhood vaccine schedule.
Oh, my gosh.
So they're taking it out with one hand and putting it back into the other. But not only that, they're putting it into pregnant women. And that is going to be, that mercury is going to be selectively taken up into the fetus. So what are they doing? If there is an acknowledgement that this should not have been in there and it is potentially dangerous, and they're getting it out on the one hand, they're putting it back on the other. And that makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Let's go to Wichita, Kansas. Ross, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Ross.
Good morning.
Morning.
When Dr. Wakefield was describing, you know, the signs for parents to look at or look for in their child, that's exactly what happened with our son.
Oh my.
When he was 18 months and right after he got the MMR shot, within a couple of months, luckily we happened to have him in a daycare where they have special needs children. And so they were kind of trained to watch for some of those signs. And they, you know, pointed out some things that were going on with him, and we were able to catch things early. But what I wanted to ask was, he was vaccinated in 1999. That's when he received the MMR vaccination at 18 months. And does that fall within the parameters of that study that the doctor mentioned earlier that showed the extreme upturn in autism cases?
It's a very good point. In the U.S., there was a protracted introduction of the MMR vaccine. It was licensed in the 70s, but in fact, it did not become the vaccine of choice for some years after that. So the rise in autism in the U.S. has been more of a steady increase, which took off again in around the late 80s, compared with those countries where it was immediately replaced, the single vaccines such as Japan and the UK. But nonetheless, the time trends in the US are consistent with a major environmental change, which could be that vaccine or could be a number of vaccines in children born in the 80s and the late 80s, yes.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, glad that helps you. What do you do next, Andrew? I mean, you've moved to the United States. You were running an autism center. You're not doing that now. What are you doing these days?
Well, I'm trying to resurrect my credibility. The problem I've had, George, is that because I've been part of this legal process in the UK, I've been unable to disclose the materials that I have, and that's been very frustrating.
Sure.
And I've accumulated a huge number of documents that have disclosed that have revealed the lies, the hypocrisy, the double dealing, everything that took place in the UK. And
would you do
the next story? Sorry.
Would you do this all over again if you had to?
Yes, I would. I think that I regret nothing. It's been a privilege looking after these children and the families. And I wouldn't. Although it has been a rocky road, my experience has been far less. The adversity for me has been far less than it is for families with affected children. I signed up when I went into medicine to put the patient first above anything else, and that is what I've done. So I like to think that I would have the temerity to do this all over again, whatever the circumstances. Easy to say, but nonetheless, the case for these children is compelling and thoroughly demands investigation. So what I'm going to be doing from now on, I'm doing two things. I'm writing a book now about the U.S. experience, what happened to me in the U.S., testimony before Congress, before Dan Burton's Oversight Committee on this issue, things that have happened to American physicians who've dared to go out on a limb and say these children need to be investigated, very much the same experience as mine in the U.K., so the story of fellow travelers. And also, I've been invited by a number of autism organizations worldwide to set up a scientific study group to look at
those aspects that the government refuses to look at. In other words, what is causing this, what environmental factors, including vaccines, are driving this current pandemic of autism worldwide.
Good for you. Can you get your license to practice medicine in the United States?
You know, I haven't tried. There are better people to do the clinical work. I've got some outstanding colleagues. My job, I feel, is to help conduct the science with the proviso that the science takes its roots from the clinical encounter, the patient's narrative, and that's the crucial thing.
All right, stay with us, Andrew. We're going to take this quick break. We'll come back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, you're listening to Coast. I'm George Norrie. The way these calls keep coming in, Dr. Wakefield, I should have kept you for 5 hours tonight. They don't stop. Have there been some settlements here in the United States with this vaccine?
Yes, there have. There have been cases settled in the U.S. vaccine court since 1991. And if people want to check these out, because some people have questioned the veracity of that, then look up the names Bailey Banks, Hannah Poling, and Misty Hyatt, just the three of the more recent cases that have been settled in vaccine court. So here we have the U.S. government accepting that these vaccines can cause autism. One thing I should say, George, and I haven't told you this, and this is maybe helpful to your listeners who want to buy the book, is if they go to callous-disregard.com. That's callous-disregard.com. They can get it there.
Okay, sure. And I'm sure, is it available on Amazon?
It is indeed.
Okay, excellent. To the phones we go, Houston, Texas. Stephanie, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you that I have a long history with autism. I grew up next door to a boy that was autistic, and he was more probably genetic, probably not vaccine related. And then somehow or another, I was at a daycare and had another student there, child there. I kept trying to get her out of her catatonic staring at the cars every day. Anyway, in my long haul of life, I became a special ed teacher. Autism was my specialty. Loved it. I then became a diagnostician, where I tested, but I couldn't do that part of the testing. But, you know, we can recognize people, and we can recommend the rest of the team to come in to do that kind of testing. Anyway, back to the vaccine. My thing is, when we were little kids, those vaccines were probably given to us with that same mercury. But we got them, like, one, maybe a month later we got another. And with my children, and I'm older, and I had children older, they got them all at one time. And so the amount of mercury in each of the three that were shot together in a little newborn's brain, I think, has a big impact.
That's a good question, Stephanie. I remember even during my childhood and my children, Andrew, they gave little doses to build up what they said the immune system. And now is it just a single vaccine, or are they still doing multiple?
Well, I think, and this is a crucial point, is the dose of exposure. Kids are getting more and more and more vaccines. If you go to that case, Hannah Poling, that I mentioned earlier, that was settled in vaccine court. This is a little girl who got 9 vaccines on the same day, a policy that has never been tested for safety. It was just a matter of convenience. The child went in, ends up with a Band-Aid on each limb. This is unacceptable. And I think this, the other thing to bear in mind is that it's not only the fact that you've got thimerosal, the mercury in there, there are high levels of aluminum in there as well, which is a known toxin to the immune system in the brain. And who knows what the effects of these things given together are. No one's tested them, and more vaccines are in the pipeline to be given. And I think that this is why it's crucial to take a deep breath, to step back and say, hold on, before we go any further, we need to be absolutely certain of where we are now and what has gone wrong.
Why do they put these chemicals and heavy metals in vaccines anyway?
Well, the thimerosal was ostensibly in there as a preservative. It's not a very good preservative. It was grandfathered in without any safety studies. And it is also, I believe, in there because it boosts the immune system. That's not what it's licensed to be in there for, but it does have the effect of boosting the immune response, producing a hyperactive immune response. That's the reason the aluminum is in there as well. It's to boost the immune response because the vaccine probably wouldn't work without it. But what is also obvious and is not taken into account is that the aluminum potentiates the effect of the mercury. So you're making a perfect storm, a very dangerous combination about which very little is known.
Okay, let's go to Charles in Palm Springs, California, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Charles. You're up.
Yeah, it's great, George. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one who talked to the plants out here. I wanted to ask you, first, Doctor, you're just a saint to take this on, because, and it's so important for Coast to Coast. That's one of the only places that really deals with varied subjects with detail. So I wanted to say thank you, guys. And, of course, we should wonder, Stewie and Family Guy, what type of shots he's had. But anyway, what I wanted to address was maybe the bigger picture. My niece had been battling in her and had never had her son have any of these shots, and she was a vegetarian, watched what they ate, and my great-nephew's now a graduate student at Stanford, got a National Endowment grant, and brilliant kid, and she was very concerned and didn't get any shots. So the other question, since you're in England, could this, on a wider scope, deal with the globalists and the Illuminati in a bigger picture wanting to wipe out the population?
Well, that's a good question. Now, he's back in the United States now.
I'm down here in Austin, Texas, so I'm a Texan now. But, I've heard these discussions about the potential sort of eugenic effect of vaccines. I cannot believe, and I know this, you know, that to some people this may sound naive, but I cannot believe that people set out consciously to do harm. And if that is the case, it's failed miserably because they're producing chronic disease rather than death. So I don't subscribe to that. I believe that, I mean, there is a saying in medicine that goes beyond medicine, and that is never substitute conspiracy where incompetence will suffice. And I think that what we're looking at here is incompetence on a meteoric scale. And a failure to pay attention to the fundamental rule of medicine, which is first do no harm. So that is my preferred view, and I hope that I never, never have to change that and come to the idea that this is more, this is a conspiracy.
Andrew, if you had a moment with Bill Gates, Microsoft founder, who has given millions for vaccine research, what would you tell him?
I would urge him. And I have, in fact, written to Bill Gates some years ago, and I would urge him to put safety first. In all the millions, the billions he's putting into vaccines, please put safety as a priority, establishing safety, because if the agenda is driven by the pharmaceutical industry, who certainly sit around the table that Bill Gates has created and influence vaccine policy, if it is driven by them, then safety will not be placed as the priority and children will be put at risk. And it would be a terrible thing for someone who is as philanthropic as Mr. Gates, Mr. and Mrs. Gates, to be involved in or to be remembered for something which ultimately led to major problems.
Let's go to Marinette, Wisconsin. Cindy's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Cindy, go ahead.
Good morning, George, Mr. Wakefield.
Morning.
Just want to let you know, I have a 14-year-old daughter. After she received her MMR shot when she was 17 months, all of a sudden she shut down. She developed what's called Asperger's. And I called the doctors because she had a reaction to the shot, and they just kept putting it off, and they wanted me to get her another shot. And I got a hold of the Autism Society, and they told me not to, so I didn't. And what a lot of people don't know is that there is a blood test that you can take that's out there. It's a titer test to see that your daughter or son still has the immunity to the MMR, which I do every year. And she has the immunity, and I don't see no reason to get her another shot because she has the immunity. Another thing I wanted to say is when I did put in for the shot reaction, I did call the FDA. They questioned 500 questions with me, and I do have a letter which I don't know if you or Mr. Wakefield might like to see. It was sent from the FDA, and the autoimmunologist states in the letter that in a non-communicable percent of children, that it does cause autism, asthma, ADHD. And also, I do have a letter from them also that they wanted to do a study on my daughter.
Okay, send that to us, and we'll get it to Dr. Wakefield. Would you like to see that, Andrew?
I would indeed. I'd be fascinated by that. Thank you very much for those comments. Asperger's syndrome is typically a higher functioning form of autism, where children do not have a delay in speech acquisition, but is still on the autistic spectrum. So that's certainly consistent with the stories that we've heard. I'm fascinated that the FDA have acknowledged to you that that is a known complication of MMR vaccine, and I would be very keen to receive that letter. And the issue of revaccination, if parents are worried and the child has already had one shot of this vaccine, you're quite right. You can get antibodies measured in the blood, which tell you whether you are immune or not to these viruses. And if you are immune, well, clearly then you're protected and you do not need a booster dose. And therefore, it is something that is well worth doing. You may need to argue the case with your doctor, but it is something that, if you are concerned, is an entirely reasonable thing to have done.
We'll get you our address, Cindy. You can get that right out to us, and we'll get it over to Dr. Wakefield. Let's go next to Providence, Rhode Island, east of the Rockies. Hello, Derek. Good morning.
Good morning, George, and good morning, Dr. Wakefield. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Dr. Wakefield, I have three children with autism, and I was wondering, we lived in a house that we found out had black mold. And we could see that our children have different degrees of autism based on how long they were in that house before we got out of there. Our youngest is the best. Our oldest is most in her own world. And we were wondering, do you know of any research that's being done right now that deals with possible effects of black mold in dealing with autism?
You know, I don't. It's a very interesting story, and I've no reason to believe that it isn't worth fully investigating. That clearly there are environmental causes of autism that go beyond vaccines. It's also interesting that molds or yeasts in the intestine of children with autism are thought to be involved in causing the actual behavioral changes in some cases, and children benefit from treatment of that with antifungals or anti-mold treatment. And it may well be that molds that one can get from a house can also produce similar toxins that can be injurious to the developing brain. So it's a very interesting story. I'm not aware of any research that's been done on it specifically, but the link between molds and fungi and autism has been previously described.
Text in from John in Riverside, California, just wants to know, what can we do to fight big pharma, if anything? What do you think, Andrew?
Well, you know, in the end, the vaccination policy depends upon the will of the people, the confidence of the people. And so this is a battle that will be won from the ground up, and it'll be won in the true principles of democracy of this country, because you ultimately, you the voter, have control. And if you say, no, we do not accept that the vaccine policy in this country at the moment is safe, it has not been established as safe, we demand that the politicians enforce change, then it doesn't matter how much money pharma lobbyists throw at politicians, whatever, it will not make any difference, because the people will have their say. So people need to realize that their vote is absolutely crucial and that they can effect change themselves. They need to get together and they need to demand a safer vaccine program for their children.
Let's go to Steve in Quincy, Massachusetts, first time caller. Steve, you're up on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, I was just curious about an answer you gave to your previous caller. I'd like to say that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was proven to be faked and killed millions. So how can you say these toxins and viruses are not intentionally added to vaccines to dumb down and control the population?
Well, he's saying he doesn't know if it is. There's a big difference.
I don't know, and I certainly hope not.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Okay. We do know that some of the people who are in various administrations have talked about population control. Henry Kissinger has. John Holdrum has. It's out there. Let's go to Reno, Nevada. Jim on the wild card line. We'll get you in here, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, George, these medical interviews are so important to get all this information out to millions of people. Thank you, thank you.
Of course.
Two questions. Is there a possibility, Dr. Wakefield, that the autism can track back to a systemic problem with the mother? That's one question. The other is, I heard a doctor talking about using a natural full puree of mangosteen juice and getting tremendous results in a double-blind placebo-controlled test showing the improvement in autistic kids. Have you heard of that?
In answer to your second question, no, I haven't. But there's no doubt, I think, and certainly in my clinical experience, that dietary manipulation can have profound effects on behavior. And so I would be very interested. And if it's been put into a double-blind randomized controlled trial, which is the gold standard in medical practice, then that is very encouraging. And I will certainly take a look at that on Google over the next few days. The first part, can problems be tracked back to the mother? It's a very important question. Mm-hmm. And some work has been done on this by a number of authors. Yes, autoimmune disease in the mother, the parents, but in the mother in particular, diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, are associated with an increased risk of autism in the infant in some studies, suggesting that there may be an immune dysregulation in the family that puts them at greater risk. The other thing to say is that Dr. Fu Yazbek from Rhode Island has done some work on maternal immunization, either before pregnancy or after pregnancy, and the risk of autism in the infant of that pregnancy or subsequent pregnancies, and has shown that there is certainly a case to be answered, to be looked at, in terms of maternal immunization. So maternal factors can and are likely to have a profound effect upon autism risk. The risk is not fully characterized as yet, but something well worth investigating.
Andrew, if a child becomes autistic, what happens when they're 20, 30, 40, 50?
Well, the tragedy now is that, I mean, one of the things that got me involved in this, got me committed to this, was a mother calling me and saying, you know, doctor, when I die or when I become infirm, no one's going to look after my child, and so when I die, I'm taking him with me. And it was a tragic story, and I've heard it many times, and sadly, it has become a reality. Many parents have taken their children's lives because they are the only ones who love them.
Oh my goodness.
And they cannot bear the idea that they are going to fall on the mercy of a society that is not prepared for them and doesn't care. And so it is a real concern, and what we need to do is to establish adequate educational, medical, and support systems for these individuals as they move into adulthood, and provide an optimal environment in which they can not only live but thrive and work, because they are wonderful people and often highly talented and productive, but you've got to have the patience and the insight and the right people on the ground to recognize that and help them through what are otherwise some very difficult problems.
Do you think the finger pointing at you is over, or will it continue?
No, I think it will continue, because the problem, George, is that I'm one of them. You see, if it were just some random person screaming that it's for vaccines out in the wilderness, that would be one thing. But because I am a scientist and a doctor and know how science works and what needs to be done, that makes it more of a threat. That's not a conceited position. That's just a fact of life. And so they have to silence me, whatever they do, and they will therefore continue their attacks. Let them. It's not personal. I don't take it personally. It's just a fact of life. It's how science has sought to crush dissent from the very beginning, and it mustn't be allowed to work. Medicine and science must not allow itself just to roll over and be kicked.
Well, good for you for having the guts, Andrew, to come forward and to put your career on the line and your reputation. And you've got a home here anytime you want. You know, anybody who calls for safety first is okay in my book. So good luck with your book, Callous Disregard.